chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, President Obama's been visiting in North Carolina. He thinks he can win. Some of us who talk to our friends wonder. His poll numbers are down. The economy is in the tank. But Barack Obama is not the first president to face a tough reelection contest. I started thinking about who would be the best person to talk to kind of get counsel about what other presidents have done in similar situations. And, of course, who better than our neighbor, the preeminent historian of the American presidency, Bill Luckenberg, who's back from Europe and Maine and has agreed to chat with us about the situation President Obama finds himself in. Welcome back to Chapel Hill, Professor Luckenberg.
Thanks, D.G. A week ago today, I was still in Austria, so it seems a little bit strange. I'm still on Austrian time. Well,
would you rather do this in German, or you want
I'll spare you that, D.G.
Luckenberg is an Austrian name, maybe, or a German name, or something.
Yeah, but my mother's name was Loretta Cecilia McNamara, born in County Limerick, so that doesn't cut it.
Well, I guess, I mean, I just feel like looking, you're in the moment if you're the president and you see the challenges that are in front of you. And maybe you forget that you're not the first guy in the world who's ever had to run for reelection and had a bad situation from which to run. And I wondered if you've been in Austria and Germany, have those people been talking to you about President Obama and what his challenges are, and what do you tell him?
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of interest in Barack Obama around the world. I remember on Inauguration Day, I was getting phone calls from as far away as China, from a Washington correspondent from Sao Paulo in Brazil, from the leading newspaper in Germany. And one of the reasons that I was in Europe these past 5 weeks was to talk about Obama, which I was asked to do in the Netherlands at the 25th anniversary of the main U.S. History Research Center on the continent. And then on the following day, there was a conference organized by British scholars who have been tracking Obama from the first day of his presidency to now. He's been holding a series of conferences. So there's not merely an interest, but an absorption.
Wow.
in Obama.
Now, and it hadn't passed. I mean, we've passed this sort of magic moment where we've elected the first African-American president, and it seemed to be an extraordinary event. Now, we're used to that, and it's not as big a deal as it used to be anyway, and we're judging him as a president rather than as, he's exploded this myth that America's a racist society.
Yeah.
I mean, it's different, isn't it, 3 years later?
It is different. And I think the main reason that the Europeans are absorbed in Obama at the moment is that they simply can't believe that the quality of his opposition is as bad as it is. I didn't find a single European in the half dozen countries that I was in who was anything but bewildered by people like Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann. And they keep asking me to explain this. How can this be? How can it be that somebody who has these views on the economy, on climate change, might become the leader of the free world? And for that reason, however critical they may be about Obama on particular matters, they feel that not just the interests of their own country, but the interests of the world is tied up in Obama's reelection. And they're very worried when they realize that he is in jeopardy.
Well, I guess that there are many Americans feel the same way, that they, in one breath, if you're on the Democratic side, you say, golly, what a lousy bunch of candidates the Republicans have been able to recruit. Anybody could be able to beat them. And then you look at some of the troubles that President Obama has, and you kind of say, well, with all of these burdens that he's carrying, anybody could beat him. And so you do start to worry about what might happen to the country.
Yeah. I think if you were to ask any political historian with a knowledge of past patterns of elections in America, is it possible that a candidate who is president of the United States with unemployment about where it was when he took office at around 9%, with no prospect that it's going to get very much better a year from now, can that man be reelected? And the answer would be no. But that does play into the question of a choice, and it's going to come down to Obama or somebody on the Republican side. And if there's not a plausible candidate on the Republican side, then clearly Obama's chances are going to be very much better.
One of the things that you bring to the table is perspective, and I have a limited look back. It's not much, not a student's perspective, but I remember back when George Bush the first was running for reelection, and the Democratic candidates lined up, and it wasn't quite the same crew that the Republicans have quality wise, but there was a lot of, you remember the dwarfs, you know, the seven that we're talking about, a group of candidates. There is the possibility that you underrate the strengths of candidates when they're in competition and when they're first getting started, and then when they break out of the pack, like Bill Clinton did, they turn out to be extraordinary candidates, better than you thought they were going to be.
Yeah, that is true. And one of the things that happened in that election is that for a time, the first George Bush's popularity was so great. After the success in the Gulf War, it peaked at 91%. Now, that's higher than any other president has ever gotten. That numbers of Democrats who were thinking of running decided against it. So that even lessened the field of plausible candidates. And Bill Clinton, among his many achievements, if that's the word, is he was the youngest governor ever to be defeated in a bid for reelection in the history of our country. He didn't seem like a winner when he first announced, but as we both know, he not only won, but then went on to win a second term.
Yeah, and that's an extraordinary accomplishment. The other burden I remember that he had and that I thought would preclude him from ever doing anything on a national basis was his sorry speech at the Democratic convention, in which he went on and on and on, and it was sort of a joke about people who couldn't stop talking, hung on. It was the Bill Clinton factor, and then he overcame everything.
Well, in addition to this, you'll recall, D.G., that he had the reputation as a womanizer, particularly the Jennifer Flowers matter. He was regarded as a draft dodger. He had admitted to smoking
doing everything but inhaling
marijuana, yes, and then made himself look worse by saying that, but he didn't inhale. And then he had organized, while a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, a protest, or had participated in a protest against the Vietnam War, which made him look as though he was unpatriotic on foreign soil, or could at least be depicted that way. So he had a lot of liabilities, and yet won.
Well, let's take a quick break and then come back and talk a little bit more about the current situation. Maybe you can give us some other examples of presidents in trouble and how they manage to achieve reelection or how they fail to do so. We're visiting with our friend and neighbor, William Luckenberg, about President Obama's challenges. He and I'll be right back.
Chapel chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Lechtenberg and I are visiting about the presidency in the context of the challenges that face Barack Obama in his Is the campaign already started, Dr.
Lechtenberg? Oh, well, certainly his visit to North Carolina gives every indication of having been the start of a campaign tour, yeah.
Robert Gibbs, the former press secretary, visited in North Carolina last month. And he said that if he could make the presidential election come down to Virginia and North Carolina, he'd take that. He said we can win these states. And obviously the president agrees with his advisor in the sense that he's spending time in North Carolina and Virginia. But as I go about, it was a close election here,
yes.
And a lot of the people who are my friends who were to varying degrees of enthusiasm voted for Obama are now less enthusiastic about it. I wonder, you've been gone, but still, what is it realistic to think that Obama could win North Carolina?
Well, I think it's realistic, but I think the odds are against him. Right now, all the indications are that he's running behind. This, after all, is a state that has been voting Republican most of the time over the past generation. People were surprised that Obama was able to win. He was the first Democrat to carry North Carolina since Jimmy Carter in 1976. And Carter had the advantage, of course, of being a Southerner. So the expectation would not be that Obama could carry North Carolina. There's another interesting aspect, which I've not seen in the few days that I've been back, covered in the North Carolina press. But yesterday's Boston Globe had a front page item that Obama was falling out of favor with African American voters in North Carolina, in addition to the other kinds of handicaps that he has in the state, thinking that he has not done enough for them, or more generally for the jobless over the last few years.
Well, let's try to find parallels for presidents who were caught on one side and trying to be close enough to the middle not to be marginalized and to compete for the persuadable votes, and at the same time hold on to the I don't want to say the radical wing, but the more vigorous adherence. I thought about Harry Truman's challenge in 1948 when he had to try to satisfy the Southern conservative wing, the racist segregationist wing of his party, and at the same time the sort of the Henry Wallace wing of the party, the liberal wing of the party, and you would have to say he was totally unsuccessful in keeping those people under the Democratic tent, but he went on and won the election. Can you find an analogy there to Obama's challenge now?
Oh, I think very much so. I think it's the best single analogy that one could find, DG. And it's obviously one that Obama is seizing upon in his visit to North Carolina. He talked about the do-nothing Congress. Those are the very words that Harry Truman used in 1948. After the midterm elections in 1946, when the Democrats did so badly, when the slogans of the Republicans were had enough, vote Republican, or to err is Truman, or don't shoot the piano player, he's doing the best he can. The U.S. News and World Report said flatly, President Truman is a one-termer. So it appeared as though all of the political waves were against him. And then, as you've just said, DG, he faced two other problems. The southern, much of the deep south wing of the party broke away, created the so-called Dixiecrats running Strom Thurmond for president. And then the left wing of the party, which was important in states like California for him to carry, broke away, creating the Progressive Party under Henry Wallace. And virtually nobody thought that Harry Truman could win again. The Newsweek magazine polled the 50 top political correspondents in the country, and all 50 predicted Truman's defeat. And if I recall vividly being, I was sent into Dick Bowling's first campaign for Congress in Kansas City. And over the course of the night, it was obvious that Dick had won. And then we got phone calls from Adlai Stevenson and Soapy Williams in Michigan, Chet Bowles in Connecticut, saying they had all won. And I remember saying to somebody, it's really too bad about Harry, isn't it? And it wasn't until the next morning that it became clear that that Truman had been elected.
Well, is that just history, or does that give any hope for Obama, or are there any lessons there for him?
Well, I think the lesson is that you've got to control the message, and the message that that Truman sent out across the country was that your troubles are not coming from the White House. The troubles are the Republican Congress. Obama's fellow Democrats have been disappointed with him, thinking that he has been too unwilling to take that kind of stand, reaching out again and again to the Republicans over the past 2.5 years when there was nobody on the Republican side, or virtually nobody, who was listening to him. He lost every vote in the House on health care and on some of the other important issues. And only recently is it clear that he's been willing to carry the fight to the Republicans and be more critical of Wall Street than he was in the past.
One of the things that we talked about earlier, and we did it sort of in a atmosphere of triumph, that the president had, against all odds really, pushed through this national health care plan, which no other president had been able to do.
Exactly.
And he of course suffered criticism about the way that he did it, but he probably did it the only way that it could be done. It got done. And now we hear nothing in terms of the triumph and the bragging about the success of that. Is it are you surprised that the country has been so negative in its reaction to the health plan? And is there a chance that by the time the election comes up a year from now, that there may be a more positive outlook on that, what we judge to be a great accomplishment?
Yeah, I think there are two problems for Obama with respect to the health plan, apart from the extraordinary exaggerations that have been made, the unfair criticisms of it. One is that the main beneficiaries of the health plan are relatively few. Those who are uninsured make up less than 10% of the electorate, and they're among those who are less likely to vote. The other is that the benefits from the health plan are going to take a few years to kick in. So the country is not able to see, as it was able to see under Franklin Roosevelt when he ran for re-election in 1936, concrete evidence of the contributions that the national government was making.
Well, we're visiting with Professor William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the presidential election in the, of Barack Obama, but in the context of a whole series of presidents who've faced similar challenges. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Distinguished professor, Kenan Professor Emeritus William Lechtenberg is guiding me as I struggle to put in historical perspective the challenge that President Barack Obama faces in his reelection campaign. Dr. Lechtenberg, as we went into the break, you brought up the 1936 reelection campaign for Franklin Roosevelt. He had three reelection campaigns. Different, weren't they, in the challenges that he faced? He managed to win all of them. What were the factors that made it possible for him to be reelected so many times? In the course of the presidency, there's a kind of ebb and flow, a honeymoon period, and then a time that you think, golly, anybody would be better than this president. Then the guy's gone, and you start reassessing. You say, well, he wasn't so bad after all.
Well, one of the aspects of FDR's first bid for reelection in 1936 is that there were still many millions who were unemployed, and that's probably the example in the past that might give the most encouragement to Obama if Obama can show that he cares deeply about those who are jobless and has a plan to improve their lot. We know how that 1936 election came out. What may be forgotten today is that the leading poll of the country, that of the magazine, the Literary Digest, predicted that Roosevelt would not only lose, but lose badly. When in fact, what happened is that Roosevelt was able to carry all but two of the then 48 states.
I'm a bad student because this is news to me. I've just read the results and got that in my mind that this was a predetermined sweep because the country was behind Roosevelt and the things that he was doing to save the country. But what you're saying is that other people saw it a different way before the election, that there were some people who thought everything he was doing was wrong and a failure, and they were going to vote him out. Was that?
Yeah. And the Literary Digest was then the most highly regarded poll. Gallup was just getting underway. The modern science of polling, of sampling, was in its infancy. The Literary Digest had never been wrong, and it was within 1% of correctly calling the popular vote 4 years before, in 1932. After the disaster for the Literary Digest with enormous FDR victory, the magazine folded. It lasted only a few months. And the main explanation that's been offered is that voting broke on class lines in 1936 to an extent that it hadn't been before, and that the Digest had been using sources such as telephone directories at a time when millions of people had no telephone. And that hadn't mattered in the past, but did in 1936.
Well, can we talk about this just a little bit more? And I'm maybe not going in the right direction in terms of things that would be helpful. But right now, as you said earlier, a president doesn't get reelected when the economy's in the tank. And you think of the Roosevelt victory in 1936 as being an understandable exception to that rule because we always thought, well, the country's still not blaming him. He's got the credit for trying to make it better. And so where I'm going with this is we now, like the literary magazine's poll, we think the president's in trouble, at least measured in the abstract, because the economy's in the tank. But is there hope for him that he can become the agent or perceived agent of, I'm the one who's working on this, as apparently Franklin Roosevelt did. I'm still working on this for you.
There are three things that are different for Obama from 1936, D.G. One is that though there was still massive unemployment in 1936, conditions were markedly better than they'd been in 1932. Whereas all of the indicators are they're not going to be better, no matter what Obama does when he runs for when the people go to the polls in next November. And that's not – there isn't anything Obama's going to be able to do about that. The other two things are these. One is that the country had a very strong feeling, despite the fact that Roosevelt was a patrician, that he cared for them. He understood what their suffering was, that he identified with them. Now, up to now, Obama has not been able to project that. The admirable thing about him is that he has this cool composure, but that cool composure doesn't, in this area, serve him well. The other thing that's different is that despite the huge stimulus package that Obama put through, there's very little sign of where that money has been spent. Very different from 1936, where you could see the TVA dams going up, the post office murals being painted, the schools being built, the highways being laid out, the Blue Ridge, the Skyline Drive, among others. If there is a way that Obama can get through part of his jobs package so that there is concrete evidence, and if he is able to show a higher degree of empathy than he's been able to project, then the analogy of FDR in 1936 becomes more credible.
Well, so if you're on Obama's advisory team, the first question is can we win on the jobs bill whether or not we are able to get it passed? In other words, if we get it passed, we've got an accomplishment to brag about. If we don't get it passed, we've got a Congress to run against. I mean, has he got a is this just a gimmick that everybody will see through?
Oh no, I don't think so. I don't think it's a gimmick. I think there are two possibilities. Since he was defeated on the jobs bill, what Obama is doing now is taking little pieces of it, like seeing if the Congress would be willing to vote money to see that firefighters are not laid off. That's going to be a very hard no vote for the Republicans to cast. If they go along with him, that will be the first of what could be a series of small but significant achievements. If they don't go along with him, that is going to greatly strengthen his argument that I'm not the person to blame. It's Congress, particularly the Republican leadership in Congress, that's to blame.
Well, on the other point that you raised, and that is the ability to empathize and relate and project empathy as apparently Franklin Roosevelt did. And as you pointed out, Franklin Roosevelt was nothing but a rich New Yorker from a patrician family and who was unable really to go walking around and, you know, running races and projecting all that. He was confined to his wheelchair most of the time. But Barack Obama is athletic. He plays basketball with the Carolina basketball team. He's got all of these ingredients that seem to make him and comes out of a less patrician background than Roosevelt did. Looks like he's got all the assets to be empathetic and to project that. And why isn't that happening? And he doesn't seem to be – I mean, he is cool and collected, but he doesn't seem to be unfriendly in any way.
Oh, not at all. The Obama of the campaign – was able to project a great deal of caring, of empathy. The moment he got in the White House, he seemed to be a changed person. I was on inauguration day, was called by NPR for the evening show and the morning show, and I listened in intently, and the expectation was that Obama was going to give a more emotional address, that he was going to cite Roosevelt, Lincoln, Martin Luther King. He did none of these things, and that set the pattern for what's ensued. More recently, including his trip to North Carolina, where in this shirt-sleeved athletic presentation, he seems more like the Obama of the campaign.
We're visiting with Professor William Lichtenberg, talking about presidential elections, the upcoming one and those in the past. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with my friend and our neighbor, William Lichtenberg, who's the distinguished historian of the presidency, and people from all over the world either call him on the telephone or they make him go to their countries. He's just gotten back from a trip to Europe, including a stint in Austria to talk to Europeans about our upcoming presidential election. And Bill Lichtenberg, I've been firing off questions to you. What would you tell us? What did you tell the Europeans? What's on your mind about the American political situation, particularly about the presidency?
Well, in Austria, the session was on American foreign policy with representatives of 27 nations, and I was asked to give the keynote in Salzburg. There, I stressed the numbers of achievements of Obama in foreign policy. I pointed out that he had hardly been in office when he was voted the Nobel Peace Prize, and although there was a lot of skepticism about that. People like Gomulka asked, oh, what has he actually done? And he hadn't done much. He nonetheless changed the face of American foreign policy from what it had been under the second George Bush, with his emphasis on unilateralism and preventive war. In the Netherlands, I gave the keynote at a different kind of a conference on one day, and then on the second day participated in a gathering of scholars mostly from Great Britain on Obama, and there was asked to talk about the relationship of Franklin Roosevelt and Obama, and Obama. In his books and in his campaign, did identify with FDR. That's been much less evident since he's been in the White House, and I think that a good deal of what hope he may have for a re-election is to be able to project the kind of personality and developed the kind of program that enabled Franklin Roosevelt to get elected and reelected three times.
Well, you've introduced this now, program, and there was a program in the first campaign. The program in the second campaign seems to be developing around sort of more of the same, refined a little bit. Are there new programs that Obama might that the country needs and that he might address in these upcoming campaign in the upcoming campaign?
Yeah, well, one of the ones that one hears the jargon word infrastructure is a throwback to Franklin Roosevelt in that I once gave a keynote address in Moscow to members of the Duma and of the Putin government, and was called on suddenly to do this when the previous speaker's wife was taken ill. And I simply took the Russians across America from the Triborough Bridge and the Lincoln Tunnel and the Cleveland Airport and the Chicago subway and the Shelter Belt all the way over to the Great Dams in Bonneville and Grand Coulee. Well, I wish that had been more a part of Obama's original stimulus package, but it wasn't. And now he appears to be talking, even though on a smaller scale, of something of that sort, of saying that much of the country's infrastructure, use that awful word, has been decaying, and here's an opportunity to improve the land and to provide jobs for.
So that would be around. That would be new if you really focused on the hard asset construction during hard times, as opposed to just pouring money into the economy as the earlier stimulus package has. Was primarily on soft assets, you know, priming the pump more than building things.
Right. And it's also hard for the opponents to attack it. You can't say I'm for bad roads and shaky bridges.
Right. Well, on another thing, before we finish up, we've been disparaging, and others have been disparaging, and you found the Europeans disparaging of the collection of Republican candidates who seem to be before us. On the other hand, there's some real interesting aspects to these candidates. And we start with the leader and the presumed winner of the – I'm not in a position to presume, but Mitt Romney seems to be moving towards the nomination. And he takes with him the same kind – there's an analogy to John Kennedy in the sense that Jack Kennedy was the had to explain and overcome the prejudice, I guess, against Roman Catholics. Romney is having a challenge in overcoming a very strong predisposition among many of his other – of people who otherwise would be supportive against his – Mormon faith. And surely you thought of that there's an analogy there and a challenge. From my standpoint, I guess we'd like for no one's religion really to get in the way of so long as they're not a captive of that public policy-wise. How do you size that challenge up for Romney?
Well, I think it is a problem. It will cost him some votes. Particularly is likely to cost him votes in the Republican primaries. His problem is more winning the nomination than winning an election. I think in a campaign for the presidency at the moment, his greatest handicap is not going to be Mormonism, but rather that he has been catering to such an extent to the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party and making statements that it's hard to believe that he believes in and is going to have to
– back away from.
Back away from.
Well, let me stick with the religion again. And you say more in the primary will be harmful to him, not so much in the general election. And it's going back a long time to 1928 when Al Smith was able to overcome his the Roman Catholic religion to get the nomination. But, boy, he got battered in typical – in some of the typical Democratic strongholds like, for instance, North Carolina and other southern states. So it could hurt him, couldn't it, in the general election?
Well, it certainly an issue that the Al Smith example that's come up again and again. Historians are not quick to say that it was Smith's Catholicism that that cost him the southern states in 1928, but his stand on prohibition and the fact that he spoke in a working class accent, he said radio rather than radio, that he was associated with Tammany Hall, the whole package of being a New Yorker, that and the Catholicism
was just an ingredient, a piece of that, just a piece of that. Well, we should say that you've become you and your buddy the filmmaker have become an expert on American drinking habits and public policy, as evidenced by the historic area of prohibition.
Yes.
You want to give a promo for that?
Well, it was on the PBS network while I was in Europe, but Ken Burns sent me a film of it ahead of time, so I was able to see it there. And this is the first time I've been an advisor to him for 30 years this year, but it's the first time I've been on camera. And I'm about to go up in a few more days to New Hampshire to spend a week with him on his next blockbuster, which is The Roosevelts,
wow.
Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor. And I'm on camera a fair amount on
wow. Well, we can't wait for that. That'll be a little while, I guess, before we get to see that. Prohibition will be back on in reruns, and we get to see that. And I hate to leave the Romney comparison, the religious challenge. The other exciting thing for me is probably is just a spark that will go out, but the Republicans are embracing Herman Cain. And you have just this momentary dream of having, could we have two African-American candidates? Is it possible that he could be nominated?
I find it very hard to believe.
Yeah, I do too, but is it, you have to
say. It certainly would be a remarkable, an extraordinary change in my lifetime and your lifetime, D.G.
Well, it would be, since we're out of time, it's a topic for another program.
We'll do
Bill Lechtenberg, when you get back from doing your movies, we'll get together again and talk politics.
I'd be happy to do that.
You're very generous to share and very wise. Thanks to Bill Lechtenberg. Thanks to all of you for listening to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back right here before you know it.